going to begin by suspending the rules, I hope, without objection, so that we can consider possible reconsideration of the vote we took on House Bill 3304 yesterday without objection. The chair then would move that we reconsider our vote whereby we sent House Bill 3304 to the floor to pass because we have an error in the bill and we're going to correct it. Is there objection? The bill is now before the chair.
Chairman, the committee amended this bill from a couple of days ago, and what at the time is that the bill had a first time your car would be impounded, second time your car would be impounded or forfeited, the third time it was the first two convictions plus being elected, the third time it was shelved and forfeited. The committee decided to change the call for May, and in discussions with the Legislative Council's office, you can already impound the car now. It would only have caused greater confusion to insert in the statute that remains forfeit when, in fact, you can already do that now. So what they did in the recommendation of good law was to put that right back to its essence, which is seizure and forfeiture. So what this does now is a motor vehicle may be seized and forfeited.
And it still exempts the existing programs.
Yes, that's correct.
All right. What are those amendments?
Mr. Dashwood.
The chair then would move the Dash 813 amendments to House Bill 3304. Discussion? Objection? The chair then would move House Bill 3304 to the floor to pass. Discussion as amended. Discussion? Objection? Order. And Senator Courtney?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney, chair.
Yes, how about we go to
2772? All right. We'll now open the public hearing on House Bill 2772. Has anyone signed up to testify on that bill? You might look in the hallway.
She was probably here at 7:30.
We'll come back to it. We'll close that for the moment and open a public hearing on House Bill 2605.
The other bills in public
hearing that are signed up for. Okay, Senator Lee's here to talk to us about 2605. This is a bill that came to us late from the Ways and Means process, and Representative Shetley worked on the interim committee in a different direction, so I asked him to be our witness.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Wayne Shetterly, State Representative District 34. And actually, my testimony will not be so much directed at the bill, but I think really just briefly to serve as a reminder to you that we, as a House and Senate, have already done in the arena of sex offenders this session, and that is through House Bill 2327 and House Bill 2328. 2327 has actually been signed into law, and House Bill 2328 just passed the Senate floor this week. Those are both bills that are a product of the Interim Judiciary Committee, where we traveled to Washington to look at their treatment program for dangerous sex offenders through the civil commitment process. And I know Senator Brown was on that group. I know that because I loaned her money to buy a book at the very bookstore.
I have my check book, but I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't want to be the one to
pay that. That's what I want.
Probably all of
37-6, I think it was.
We Democrats have to live frugally.
Yeah, I thought a Democrat would want to support it. I think this is a Republican trait.
I was raised in a Republican household.
That's been challenging,
huh? My parents sure think so.
Very good luck you so far, it's right.
Thank you very much.
But just briefly, if you recall, these are the bills that were the product of the group, and we looked at the prospect through the interim of civil commitment for dangerous sex offenders that around Washington has gone, where the person approaches the end of their prison term for a certain class of sex offenses, where they're designated as a sex offender for civil commitment purposes and then are retained indefinitely, or retained indefinitely, of course they have to be recommitted periodically, but are retained in a what is called a civil commitment, although it looks and feels for all the world to be prison. We rejected that as a model for Oregon because of the cost and because of a number of other factors that we saw in the Washington program, and went instead with the proposals that we passed as House Bill 2327 and House Bill 2328 that provide for lifetime post-prison supervision for this class of dangerous sex offenders. We thought that would be a more cost-effective way to deal with the very dangerous population and without all of the attendance there. Problems of retaining them, especially in civil commitment, but in any form of custody. And so my purpose today, I think, is just to remind you that in this area of dangerous sex offenders, we have already made some significant headway this session with the House Bill 2327, 28. And so anything that you do today, I would just ask you to keep in mind at least that we are already moving in this direction.
So, in your opinion, 2605 wouldn't fit into the programs we've already passed?
I don't see it, myself, I don't see it working hand in glove with 2327 and 2328. It appears to be moving in a different direction.
Thank you.
I don't know, though, there may be some two amendments and reconcile, but I think at this point it goes a different direction than we've charted with the two bills that we've already passed.
Questions, Representative?
A significant difference? I mean, or do you think this is a good idea, or is this the wrong direction we're moving in?
Well, I guess I'll leave that to you. I just wanted to make sure that we all, you know, as the press of bills comes through at the end of the session and these things come up quickly, sometimes we lose contact. And my purpose, I think, is just to remind you that we've already moved this direction on the issue of dangerous sex offenders with 2327 and 2328, and that it has to be cognizant of that, I guess, if you are going to look at the bill that's before you and how that relates to 2327, 2328, and so that we're not looking across purposes, even though there may not be technical or drafting conflicts between these. Philosophically, I think they're moving in different directions.
That's helpful to me. Thank you for
coming
in early this morning.
I'm glad to do it. Have a good day.
Ingrid Clinton.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, Ingrid Clinton, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Following up on Representative Shetterly's testimony, indeed, this would be a completely different manner of dealing with sex offenders than 27 and 28. As he indicated, throughout the course of the interim work group, consideration was given to a multitude of approaches to dealing with folks who have offended sexually and are deemed to be dangerous. In those other bills, which you have passed out some time ago, the approaches to create some standards for identifying sex offenders who not only have committed sex offenses, but are dangerous and are deemed to be dangerous in a long-term sense, so that treatment interventions are unlikely to be successful with those folks. And the process involved in those bills involved a conviction, and then at the sentencing phase, the courts takes evidence about not only the offense, but also there are evaluations which are done by the state, by the defense, to determine whether or not this person has propensity to commit further violent sex offenses in the future. And if so, that person then is subject to aggregation at the time of sentencing plus lifetime supervision. so that if a person finishes their initial sentence, whatever that might be, and these are all ballot measure 11 offenses that we're talking about, so they have significant minimum sentences, at the conclusion of that prison term, then a person is subject to intensive supervision throughout the course of his release after finishing the confinement period. And intensive supervision involves being aware of that offender and where he is at all times and making sure that he is safe in the community. Then allowing for return of that offender for 180 days at a time if the offender is not following through on some significant part of his post-prison supervision. The idea is to catch those offenders when they're recycling and before they reoffend, so that if they are violating some term of post-prison supervision that has to do with their successful completion of that, they can be revoked and returned to the institution without a new offense occurring. This approach, on the other hand, just sort of determines that if you've committed one of these offenses in the past and had an opportunity for treatment at some point, whether or not you actually were treated, and then reoffend, you will spend the rest of your life in prison, even though you may not be deemed to be predatory or to be a dangerous offender. And it makes no provision whatsoever for a determination at some point in the future that even if you were dangerous at some point, you no longer are for whatever reason. So that even geriatric patients who had perhaps two offenses in their entire life and have spent 50 or 60 years in prison would not be eligible for release under the terms of this bill. I think another important thing to know is that among the offenses included here, sex abuse in the first degree, the offenses included in the bill are rape one, sodomy one, unlawful sexual penetration one, sex abuse using a child in a display of sexually explicit conduct. Even though these are first degree offenses, the conduct ranges from violent rape, which would be rape one, or sexual contact with minors under certain ages. So first degree offenses have to do with minors under the age of 12. Rape and sodomy, etc., involve completed sexual acts. Sexual abuse in the first degree does not. It includes the mere touching of a child under 12 on a sexual part of the body with the intent to arouse the person or the child, and it can be over clothing. So that offense in particular doesn't carry with it the same kinds of conduct that some of these others do. But as I said, all of these are Measure 11 offenses, so the minimum sentences are in the range of 90 months. And that's assuming that the court decided to impose only the minimum sentence. Because if a person has a pattern of sexual misconduct, or if a person is being sentenced on one offense, but has been convicted of multiple offenses, or has been connected with multiple offenses, the court can add to that minimum sentence. So if you're looking at the second-time offenders, which is what this bill deals with, at the very least, they will get the Measure 11 sentence, but in all likelihood, they will get a significantly longer sentence than that. So I don't think it's necessary to look at a life sentence as a deterrent in these cases. To the extent that prison terms can deter these kinds of offenses, the offenses already carry those kinds of sentences. So we would ask you to consider the course that you took with respect to 2327 and 2328 as the appropriate way to address this issue, rather than imposing life sentences on a large number of folks, some of whom may not need them.
My inclination is let's see what we've done with that other legislation and just let this go. Okay. Do we need any more discussion with him? All right. We'll close the hearing. Open the discussion. We're trying to move the table. House Bill 2605. Discussion? Objection? Gordon. We will now go back to public hearing on House Bill 2772. John Ellen.
Good morning, Chair Bryant and members of the committee. I apologize for not being here when you called.
We were speculating that someone was giving you this and now thought you had to be here at 7:30, so that's the way the time of the meeting last week.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, thank you for hearing House Bill 2772 today. Ford and Gunner's requested House Bill 2772 for through Representative Nanny. And the bill is the reincarnation of House Bill 3332 from the last legislative session introduced by Representative Carter. House Bill 3332 passed the House last session with 42 ayes, 1 nay, and 17 excused, and in this session it passed the House in House Bill 2772 form with 58 ayes and 2 excused. Ford and Gunner believes that those who choose to engage in drive-by shootings should face as many consequences as possible that we can levy on those individuals. Just as Oregon has allowed for forfeiture of vehicles in prostitution cases, we believe that this is a logical extension of that philosophy. And during the last session and this session, the language has been carefully crafted and reviewed to address concerns over the use of the vehicle. Therefore, when it was originally introduced, we had said that any vehicle used in drive-by shooting, now it's just any vehicle that's been used in drive-by shooting, that the owner is in the vehicle. Therefore, you can be sure that other people's vehicles will not be subject to forfeiture. It has to be with the owner present in the vehicle. With that, it's a pretty fairly simple bill, a couple of short sentences, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions for Mr. Hill?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you aware, maybe this is not fair to us to this, but are you aware of where the other gun organizations are, the NRA and the Gun Owners of America, what their position is on this bill?
In testimony on the House side, I believe the NRA was supportive of the bill, and I don't recall if the other representative from Gun Owners of America spoke to this bill at all. I don't recall. Senator.
And then another question is, what was the, you said the last year's version had any motor vehicle could be forfeited whether or not the owner was in it?
Right.
And this session you took a different, why was that change made?
There was some concern that you get in a circumstance where either A, the vehicle was stolen, or B, the vehicle was taken without the knowledge, maybe in a relative's vehicle that was taken. And then it would not be fair to the owner of the vehicle if the vehicle was taken without the knowledge of the owner. Therefore, it was crafted to just specifically address those individuals who were the owner of the vehicle and in the vehicle at the time that it was used at in a drive-by shooting.
And did you give any thought to having, if somebody lent a vehicle to somebody with their permission to making that differentiation?
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, we did not, and I think that the motives behind it, if I were to think of that now, I would say that would seem to be a pretty significant burden to overcome in proving when it came to forfeiture hearing or the forfeiture process, that it would be somebody could just simply say, the guy took my car, I didn't have him. But I certainly think that if that's something the committee wants to pursue, I'm not as knowledgeable in the area of what it takes to prove the intent or the what it took for somebody to loan their vehicle. I'm not savvy enough to know that sort of a legal burden. So if you'd like to do that, it's your prerogative.
John, under subsection H, intimidation, would an example of intimidation be if you're in a car and you're cruising down a crowded street or a well-used highway and you cap off a round in the air? Would that be considered intimidation? Well, what would be a definition of intimidation?
That's a good question, Senator, and I'm afraid I don't have the answer to that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I ask Mr. Klein if he could enlighten me a little bit and what would be considered?
I think that would be very appropriate.
Put on a special shirt in the morning.
He's wearing a suit. Let's ask him.
Yes, President.
Mr. Penn, I'm kind of curious if intimidation would be a case of where that's a kid in a car shooting down a main drag, and one of them cast up a couple rounds in the air. That would be construed as intimidation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tarnow, I don't believe so. This particular crime, citing these statutes, this used to be, some people refer to it as racial intimidation, but this crime is committing another crime, such as a physical assault from misdemeanor to felony assault, or a criminal mischief type of crime, with the additional aggravator of you're doing the crime because of someone's race or religion or different protected categories. So it is an assault or a property damage crime plus the intent to do this crime because this person is a member of this class. And that's called the crime of intimidation. So just firing a gun in the air probably would only be firing it straight up in the air could potentially be a violation of a city ordinance of firing a gun within the city limits. If you're shooting at somebody, that's a totally different situation.
And in reading the statute on intimidation, if shooting at someone or if you intend to cause substantial property damage by your shooting, probably in the air it wouldn't, but if you're aiming at something else, that might be considered, it probably would be property damage and come under intimidation.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. I guess
Mr. Chair?
Damage. Yep, sorry.
Some of us haven't we had some other bill or something trying to define the drive-by shooting, whether you have to be the actual shooter of the gun? I mean, is this statute clear? If another person is in the car and shoots the gun, this ambiguity in this, it would indicate that, well, there wasn't any intent or something by the driver.
I think the intent is of the bill, if the driver's in the car and someone else shoots, he's close to the car.
Yeah, I'm just that car. Oh, that's what I assumed. That was, you know, could you in this thing say, well, the driver didn't know he was pulled the gun out?
Should you say it?
Someone who committed a subject to civil unrest for Mr. Chairman, I would agree that is discretionary.
Similar to the other forfeiture bills we talked about.
Correct, Mr. Chair. I mean, I guess you could read it as much as the same name. It doesn't say show.
Okay,
and maybe that discretion is good because you might have a situation where because of peer pressure or surprise, the driver or the owner of the car didn't know the gun was there and suddenly it's there and it fires. So they may forfeit their car, but not necessarily so. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Chair, in a criminal charge, if we were charging someone for participation in a crime, we're going to have to show that they're an aider and abettor, and we're going to have to show they have the intent to assist and aid in the crime. This being a different statute, I think it is discretionary, and it would be open to the facts, and you could have a situation where someone, a passenger, brought the gun in, hidden under their coat. Legitimately, the driver had no idea it was there. I think that allows some discretion. Those are few and far between, I mean.
You did that with some skepticism. Other questions? Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 2772, open for discussion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2772 to the floor of your contract recommendation.
Senator Tarnow moves House Bill 2772 to the floor to pass. Discussion? Objection? So far. Senator Tarnow, would you carry the bill? Thank you. On 2585, I'm going to hold that to this afternoon and send it to Courtney. I saw Pat Hearn in the office and the beginning earlier, and Greg Bill heard the argument a little bit. And be here on the 28th. We're going to go to a public hearing on House Bill 2870. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. For the record, my name is Joseph Padger. I work for Representative Leonard. Sir Bryant, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, thank you for allowing me to testify on House Bill 2870 today. I'll try to keep my comments short as the bill is short and I don't need to waste your time. Basically, 2870 relates to juveniles and would require parents to attend juvenile court hearings. The point of this is that juvenile court proceedings proceed better with the parents there, mostly because there's better communication between the court, the parent, and the child as far as sentencing and or requirements that the parents can have. And we think that's important, partially because parents are responsible for civil restitution in the state of Oregon. Well, occasionally, or actually most of the time, are responsible for civil restitution. Another reason for this is that many of the juvenile justice employees I spoke with believe that requiring a parent to be a part of the process helps calm the child in court. They also believe that having a parent in court alleviates miscommunication. This bill would also provide a little worker protection in the respect that it would allow the employee to go to court without the possibility of losing his job. That would be a defense to losing your job. It would create a wrongful termination suit. First, that kind of sounds like it's worker protection, but really what it does is it removes the excuse that many parents use that, oh, I can't come because I have to go to work. So we were kind of hoping that would work in two ways. One, to protect employees, but also in order to remove that excuse, the parents would be more likely to come. In actual practical application of this, what would happen is if the parent was ordered to come to court and they did not show up for whatever reason, the judge or presiding officer could in fact send out a deputy to get them if they could locate them at their house, wherever, and have them brought to the proceeding. There wouldn't be any punitive penalty, it wouldn't be a misdemeanor, or there would not be any fine.
For failure to follow a court-ordered summons, you could be held in contempt. A bench warrant could be issued.
Could be, yes, absolutely. In closing, I just wanted to say that the bill will make a difference because it will compel parents to attend their court proceedings. And that way they don't have the option of opting out from neglect or laziness. And it would, by having this worker protection, we would remove that excuse to give the judge and presiding officer one more reason to have the parent attend court. I guess the purpose of this and the hope is that parents would be required to attend all hearings and that the judge would let them out of it in cases where, you know, there's child, for example, child care issue or, one, other children that have to be taken care of and this parent can't afford to pay for, and or a parent could be in jail or a parent might be out of the state. Other than that, we kind of were hoping that the judge would require a parent to attend all juvenile court hearings.
Subparagraph G, and Mr. Travis might have an answer to this rather than you, Joseph, but it says parents or guardians summoned pursuant to paragraph A of the subsection shall appear personally pursuant to the summons. So the court still has the discretion if he says that would be a waste of time not to include parents in the summons.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Timothy Travis from the Oregon Judicial Department. Before I answer the question, let me state that the department is neutral on this bill, and we have provided technical support to the representative in putting it into a shape that it would work and be good for everybody. The answer to the chair's question is yes. The judge would have the discretion of every step of the way as to whether to excuse or require the attendance of the parent.
And what I want to avoid is to make sure that the juvenile who gets adjudicated can't raise, wait a minute, my parents weren't summoned, so what the court has done, that is an appealable order.
Gee, Mr. Chair, I never thought of that. I don't think that could happen, Your Honor. It's the judge's discretion whether or not to do it. The child doesn't have the right to have the parent.
Actually, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project, actually the juvenile code right now requires that parents be a part of a dispositional hearing on a delinquency case, and if the parent, if the disposition goes forward without the parent can come in and say, I want to have another hearing, and I want to do this all over again. So I don't think that this would create a a way that the juvenile could say, wait a minute, but I think the parent still would have the ability to say, I was supposed to be there, you proceeded without me, and I now want you to do my child's disposition all over again.
So you would agree it wouldn't give the juvenile the right to appeal the decision because the parents weren't summoned?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. Sure.
That's too long.
Other question?
I could say it again.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to add, if I could, that for a lot of years I've been involved in discussions on reform of the juvenile justice system. And one of the things that people constantly bring up is that parents should be involved. Some people feel that it's a matter of parental responsibility and it's a little punitive for the parents that they should have to be there. Others, from a more positive point of view, say that parents should be there because they should be engaged with their children and we should facilitate that. Whichever side you come from, there's a consensus that it's a good thing. The problem has always been in the past that parents, many of them are single parents, they have employment problems, and they can't come. This gives them much of the same protection that a person on jury duty has to say that you cannot be prejudiced in your employment. So that's why this bill adds something to the code. It doesn't add much in terms of requiring the parent to be there, because the summons law really already does that.
Why are you neutral?
Because the Oregon Judicial Department doesn't really take positions on substantive law, except in some circumstances. This is merely a procedural kind of thing. So we're not advocating one way or the other for the bill, but we did work on making it very workable. You should not read anything negative into that, Senator.
It's just unusual for you to be neutral on anything.
Can an emancipated youngster, would the court have records of that emancipation? Do we know if that youngster was emancipated, was the parents or exonerated from having to appear?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We will close and the public hearing on HB 2870.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2870.
We have some amendments here. Frankly, I don't know if it came off. Okay. But the statute is free. And I made line 22 to 26.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Timothy Travis came from the Judicial Department. That these amendments were, that was language that should have been taken out on the House side. And what that language did was it involved the juvenile court as the court to adjudicate the dispute if a parent was prejudiced in their employment, rather than having that dispute settled through the normal course of bullying and all that stuff.
That would be an inappropriate extension of the jurisdiction of the juvenile court if it didn't inform the parent.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Tarnow then moves to the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 2870. Discussion? Objections?
I have the A3.
Are there A4?
The same thing.
Okay.
This year I'll move the bills amended.
Thank you. Senator Tarnow, I'll move House Bill 2870 as amended to the floor of the Senate. Discussion? Objection?
Carrier.
Okay. Thanks. All right. We'll now go to House Bill 3492. And we have some amendments.
This is the gray market, if you will, federal cigarette labeling act legislation. Let's just not bring state law in line with that federal law. The A11 amendment requested by the retailers and distributors that provide some notice provisions pending the sale or destruction of improperly labeled cigarettes. Again, we've got the board already. And A14 for you represent an agreement between the grocers and the OJ. And they are a little bit less than the 810 through 13 that you have seen previously. Specifically, in Section 8, Clause 3 on page 1 of the OJ, A14, you'll note that there is now a graduated penalty for minors, close to 18, who purchase their 10% of tobacco. First time violation, court may order them to back with the program. second violation, they may be required to participate in that program if they have not done so before, and requires the court to order a suspension of driving privileges. In addition, the community could be ordered to perform community service. The difference between the amenities seen before is that the community service is specifically related to the meeting associated with the product. On page 2, sub 8.4 up at the top, starts the language that you had discussed. And then the amendments also remove a provision that would have permitted minors in a private home in the
the inappropriate now for a minor, even in their home, to smoke with their parents' consent.
And that, the provision that was in there, but would have done that, mirrored the MIP, the alcohol statute, and these amendments should be removed that since this is a tobacco.
So basically, you're no longer saying it's illegal for a minor to smoke in their house with the permission of their parents?
That's not a violation.
It
would be a violation.
It is a violation. This is tougher than minor in possession.
Okay. Early. The balance pages 2 through 16 are the amended statute that it does track the white
system. What has happened, committee? If you recall, we adopted some amendments that were identical to what we do with minor possession of alcohol. The Attorney General had some concerns, and so the industry and the groceries met and came up with sort of a -A14, and these are consensus amendments that do what Ann has just described. I think it makes sense to the way the first sentence ended and the community service related to this also. I wasn't here when the minor possession in the home situation was adopted, but I presume that might have been done because parents may allow a minor to taste some wine or something like that. I'm not sure it's a good public policy to have that exception in the minor in possession if we want to send a statement that it's inappropriate. In fact, no matter if you allowed a minor probably to have a taste of wine in your home, you aren't going to be found to be in violation of anything. It's hard to enforce unless the police chief is the guest at dinner or something, or Mr. Penn. But I'm just speculating as to why that exemption was put in there in the minor in possession.
Mr. Chairman, I really like the policy of reentry and plan to discourage smoking, but I am concerned about anything that regulates behavior in someone's own home. And I'm just wondering if maybe we could ask Mr. Penn to comment on how that would be likely to be enforced.
And by the way, this particular section, this was requested by the Attorney General. It wasn't from the grocery division. As a practical matter, I'm not sure how you enforce it one way or another, but Mr. Penn, do you have some comments?
This has been going on a lot.
Mr. Chair, I unfortunately haven't totally followed this bill, and so I don't know all the discussions about it, but anytime you talk about invading, government invasion into a home, into a family relationship, and what is going on between those family members, that's a very difficult process for law enforcement. And you're correct. These are violations, so you cannot do search warrants for these. So it's really going to come someone reporting that I saw this occurring. it is a very difficult process for the law enforcement to be involved in it. I don't have a good solution for you. I think you're right on some of the policy issues, but certainly the home has constitutional protection that makes it very unlikely for the criminal justice system to be a participant in this.
Someone handed me a note that said also on the alcohol, they were concerned about freedom of religion, and so that might have been the reason why they also allowed the friends of my dad to drink any wine in all sort of situations.
And Mr. Chair, you have all of the medical testimony about where you have a little bit of wine, it's good for you medically. I mean, there are different issues that would come up, I think, but it is a complicated issue.
Thank you.
DNG has requested that it's approved the suspension amendment that you officially amended to have an operative date of 4/1/2000 for Y2K and playground reasons. And the committee could do two things. One, that penalty is not available until 4/1/99, or that penalty is available now, but the suspension will be effective in 4/1/2000.
Okay. That's probably better. I think it'll have the same effect. The chair then would make a conceptual amendment to the -A14 amendments to House Bill 3492 to provide that the portion dealing with the suspension of driver's license, any suspension not be effective until 4/1/2000. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. The chair then would move the -A14 amendment as conceptually amended.
Chair, yeah, clarification. This business about in a home decision. But is that still part of the dashboard?
It is. It is on page 2, it's subsection 4.
that's
Steiner. No, it's Steiner.
Yeah.
It's not in the amendment. It isn't.
Under parent supervision. Is that in the -14 language?
It removes the provision that was in the -12 that mirrored the MRT statute.
Mr. Chair, I won't be on board because of that issue. That concern. It bothers me that we're going into the homes, not such a minor issue.
I don't
like
that part yet. What do you think about that?
Yeah.
We have to put it back in. Could we do this? This has to go to another committee.
Okay.
It's in about 800 languages on line 439 that you have to
learn.
It says that the guardian of the minor is the guardian of consent. No person under age 18 shall have personal possession of consent. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So what you're saying is that by remaining silent, the prohibition on a minor being in possession of tobacco would automatically cover
the home.
The home.
Yeah.
So we're not explicitly saying that it covers the home. It's a little bit different.
Ingrid has a point to raise that she, on Boxer home.
I'm sorry, I just can't sit and listen without mentioning that I represent a number of kids who are in foster care, and they're teenagers, they're, you know, 15, 16-year-old kids. And if they were not allowed to smoke, they would leave those foster homes, and they would take off. I mean, and the foster parents don't want them to smoke in the house, but they tolerate this behavior because they don't want them to run away. And I'm telling you that because I have three current clients for whom that's such a critical issue. They would literally be home.
All right. I'm going to draw my motion up another conceptual amendment. Going back to the 810, which was section 8, which reads, no person under 18 years of age shall attempt to purchase or acquire tobacco products as defined in ORS 431.840, except when such minor is in a private residence accompanied by the parent or guardian of the minor, and with the parent or guardian's consent, no person under 18 shall have personal possession of tobacco products. Okay. Any objection to that conceptual amendment? Says Hardy Meyer. He's not voting today, so we'll do it.
That's great.
The chair then would move the dash A14 amendments as conceptually amended into the bill.
Chairman,
yes.
Your conceptual amendment did not interfere with the ability of mine to participate in staying off the
That's a good thing. We're still doing that.
No objection? Well, Carrie, the chair then would move, so I don't have to do that. That's all we want. This then will go, the chair would move that House Bill 3492 is amended. Go to the Public Affairs Committee.
Oh, goody.
Discussion. I do. Thank you, committee. Thank you, Ann. I didn't think it was possible.
That's a good point.
And there might be other situations where you have a 15-year-old with a problem at home and you know them around to look or try to report this, they might take off. Well, what brings you up here today?
Well, it's 2801.
All right, we will go to work session on House Bill 2801. Oh, please.
Mr. Chairman, as the committee will recall, this is the criminal trespass three bill. Representative Jason Atkinson's bill, and he testified a few days ago. Law enforcement had a few concerns that were testified to, and the 86 amendments, which were before the committee today, I believe, would resolve those concerns. What the 86 amendments do is take this from the new offense that was originally classified as a violation in the criminal code, and rather make this a civil cause of action. That removes any potential conflict for either proportionality reasons or whether legal reasons.
We don't have any
criminal
reasons.
Okay. I don't have any. They are back there. We can go against them. They were brought to our office late last night. What the A6s would do is make a civil cause of action and remove any conflict with the existing statutes and criminal trespass do. I do think that that resolves the problem, and if the committee did want to move control of the A6s would be one option.
The problem with the bill initially was that if we adopted it, it would be in conflict with trespass too. It actually left an offense for
sure.
It was confusing. And, I mean, it was well-intended, but it wouldn't accomplish a purpose.
Mr. Sherman, I can tell you, I discussed this with Representative Atkinson. He's fine with the A6 amendments, and he believes they will do what he needs to do.
And we did this on two other matters this year, where we made it a civil matter. One was on the court official, and another one was trespass cows and whatnot, I think. Cow kissing and those sorts of things we added to civil penalty. But I think will be better because DAs are going to have a lot of time to enforce those other matters anyway. So this is a district attorney improvement bill. The chair then removes the dash A6 amendments to House Bill 2801. Discussion? Objection, sir. The chair then will move 2801 as amended before due pass. Discussion? Objection, sir.
Okay, then.
Thank you.
Carl, very good thing to do.
Good.
Good job on this.
Representative Atkinson is very happy with that. It'll help you in future sessions. And thank you, John, for the work on that. We've had up against the wall about four times on that, trying to find a solution, and then this is a good way to go.
Good.
All right. Are the amendments to 3374 ready?
I believe they are. I don't think we did end up having any conflict amendments on that bill, so I think we could proceed on that.
Alright, I don't have those amendments. Are they in the back room over?
No, we do not have conflict amendments, but I think the committee has already had passed out all the amendments to the bill. 3.7 would be the new one.
Didn't we do a conceptual amendment on this yesterday? That, well, on the affirmative defense, which is...
I don't think the committee actually adopted that, Mr. Chairman, but it was set, and we could proceed on that today. I think maybe one of the
sure if we'll be meeting with you for the moment, but why don't we do that? Okay, well, I am. We do. Okay. All right. We'll begin with the
B20. We don't have a problem here, shall we?
We do. Great. Okay. Mr. Chairman, the B20 is set aside to, I believe, by the Attorney General's office. They clarify, and I think correct some technical language regarding the possession of a handgun. I believe that was it. Any further questions?
Yes. Chair would move the dash B20 amendment. Discussion, objection, report.
Mr. Chairman, we can skip the B21. Those are not something that I believe the original request was wanted to proceed on, but the B22s are before the committee. It's been testified to you by both of Ingrid Spence and then pertains to the joinder. The committee didn't have any idea of a couple of conceptual amendments. On the bottom of B22, on line 24, removing the word clearly. On the top of page 2, on line 2, removing the word strongly. And the committee wanted to do that, the committee could, and then pass the B22, the committee couldn't pass.
As I recall the testimony of B22, really the subsection 4 doesn't add anything to the bill. The key is to get the word substantially prejudiced on line 19 and 20 of the dash B22. So the chair would move a conceptual amendment to the B22s to delete subsection 4 beginning at line 23. Discussion? Yes.
I'm using my bill filter on this. What does the amendment do?
This is, there was a case that Mr. Kim and Ingrid Swenson testified about dealing with the court struggling with what is meant by prejudice and whether it was intended to mean substantially prejudice. And since the law was silent, Mr. Kim thought you needed the words to add the word substantially prejudice to the bill, to the current statute. Then in addition to that, he added a subparagraph 4 talking about jointly charged offenses, and Swenson pointed out that there are reasons when, even though there's similar circumstances, you don't jointly charge, and the court has the discretion whether or not to do that. And in fact, it was State v. Miller, was that the case? The court, wrongly, she felt, determined even in that situation, the court said you were allowed to have jointly. So, my thinking was because paragraph 4 wasn't necessary in response to that particular case. Objection? Chair then would move the dash B22 amendments as conceptually amended into the bill. Question? Objection?
Chairman, the B23 amendments are a clarification to the carrying of concealed weapons statute. There's a phrase in there which is and commonly known as, which the court ruled unconstitutional some time ago. That phrase has been ignored by the courts, by prosecutors, by defense attorneys for some time, and it simply involves picking up the statute and taking that language out.
The chair would move the B23 amendments. Discussion? Objection?
Mr. Chairman, the B-24 amendments were never discussed, but this is also a technical clarification that I think I could inform the committee about in about 30 seconds. Currently, there are two statutes dealing with assault through an emergency medical technician.
That falls under assaulting a public safety officer, which is a class A misdemeanor.
It also falls under assault in the third degree. The requirements for that, as it pertains to emergency medical technicians, are precisely the same. This is not meaning those statutes.
And in fact, there could be an argument that really only the lesser offense, the class A misdemeanor, would apply to emergency medical technicians. It is a confusing overlap. And taking that out of the expulsion of public safety officer statute is simply a clarification because already it can be prosecuted as an assault.
Or EMT, assault
on EMT. And I've discussed this with Roger Martin, who represents EMTs, and he is. As I understand, it's used to be able to read something very hard.
I would move in the B-24 amendment. Discussion? Objection?
Mr. Chairman, the B-25 amendments are very similar to what we just did with the B-23s. The commonly used language has also been ruled unconstitutional in a crime which is called possessing burglary. All this amendment does is to remove that phrase from the statute and does not lessen or increase the ability to prosecute that one.
The chair would move the B-25 amendment. Discussion?
Objection?
Mr. Chairman, the remaining amendments before the committee are any alternatives to B-26 and the B-27. They pertain to aggregation of criminal mischief offenses, and I don't recall that we had any testimony on this yesterday. In good point from the jail, and may want to speak to this, I don't know, to briefly explain the issue. Currently, under theft law, if a person steals within 30 days several things, several different victims, those can be combined into one offense. If a person steals from the same victim over 180 days, those offenses can be combined as well. However, under criminal mischief statutes, that currently is not permitted. Aggregation is not a crime of criminal mischief, which again is property damage. What both the B-26 and B-27 amendments would do is to allow for aggregation of criminal mischief statutes. The difference between the two is that the B-26 amendment reflects what is currently done for theft by saying that if there are multiple victims within a 30-day period, that can be aggregated. If there is the same victim within a 180-day period, that can be aggregated. The B-27 amendments are a little bit different, and they provide that if there are multiple victims in the same course of conduct, so that will probably be one day, then that can be aggregated. Or if it is the same victim, that aggregation can only occur if it is within 30 days. The other thing that the B-27 amendments do is to raise the threshold for charging a person with criminal mischief one, which is a felony, from $500 to $750. Now, the reason for that, or at least one of the reasons that has been requested, is because theft one currently has a threshold of $750. Criminal mischief is right now at 500. This would raise the level to the same level as the currently used to come like that. And I think the merits of that up to the committee.
Why don't we have a little testimony on these alternatives, Kindred and Dale?
Mr. Chairman of the Kenny Ingrid Swenson Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We certainly would oppose the B-26 amendments for a number of reasons. I think particularly to do with aggregating offenses that occur over a 180-day period. That's extremely long. As far as I know, it's unprecedented except in cases like conspiracy and so forth to commit major crimes. But to take conduct over a 6-month period and say if you committed an offense in March and then another minor offense in June, we're going to add those together and make that one offense and make it a felony. So just conceptually and sort of practically, that's a concept that would be fairly novel, and I haven't thought about the constitutional implications, and there might be some. However, with the B-27s, I have less of a concern. My members, when I talked to them about this proposal, basically said there's almost not a criminal mischief that isn't a felony anymore, and that has to do with inflation. If somebody takes a key and scratches a car, it's going to be a felony, just, you know, a single paint job on a car, and if you do multiple cars, you're going to have multiple felonies. From that point of view, aggregating what occurs within a 30-day period against the same victim makes some sense, because there's probably an intention or a pattern of somebody trying to commit damage to a particular person. If we're talking about conduct that's connected in time, so that if you go down the street and scratch 5 cars and you just do minor damage to each of them, then maybe that's appropriate in that instance to aggregate it. So the D27s in that sense makes some sense to me. Also, raising the felony threshold to make it conform to the Theft 1 statute, I think would be an appropriate thing to do.
Which is the 750.
Yes, it is.
Mr. Penn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney. These aggregation rules and Dash 26 amendments, as you were told, are really reflecting what the rules are now for theft cases. And really how this came about was that in the past, there were very general judicial guidelines about aggregation. And it was determined that it would be appropriate to have a very clear line that everyone would understand. And so that was put in statute a number of years ago. And this idea, if there are multiple people, let's cut it off at 30 days.
if there's one victim over a long period of time, let's cut it off at 6 months. So it's very clear, easy to establish, and we don't get into these heated legal debates about should it be 9 months in this case and 3 months in this case or this number of victims in that case and all of those issues. And so that's how this came about. It has been a good rule in theft cases. And so the argument, the policy argument would be, it's a simple, clear rule. This is a property crime type of offense, just like theft. And so it should use the same. And the same idea with the Dash 27, so let's use the same dollar amount. But if we are going to use the same dollar amount to judge a felony in the Dash 27, let's use the same aggregation rules as we do for theft to add up to those amounts, what's a felony and what is a misdemeanor. So I think that's the policy choice. This has been in place for a number of years. In theft, it works well, it's clear, everyone understands it. And the way this would come about is criminal mischief. What we're really talking about here is, I can't think of a slang term, but basically going in and vandalizing large numbers of cars in neighborhoods. And what will happen is, in one night, it's not one or two cars, it can be 30 or 40 cars that are damaged. And so the issue is, you have a big legal battle about, is this one transaction in this night when they damage 40 cars, so that we should add those all together and say that's one big felony, or is this 40 misdemeanor cases? And this rule makes it very clear. If it's within this finite period of time, it's going to be one big felony case rather than a whole bunch of little misdemeanor cases. And so that's the concept and the policy choice.
But that criterion would be met by the B-27, too, because that would be one course of action, right? Multiple victims in the same course of conduct. That's the example you just gave.
Ms. Sharon, Senator Burdick, yes, the Dash 27s does have a little definition there for aggregation. I guess the difference, just looking at the differences between the 26 and 27, Mr. Horton may be able to correct me on this. It does give you that the more than one person within a 30-day period, but they are a little bit inconsistent. I just looking at that now, I recognize that it is two different rules. I thought they were trying to have the same rule.
When you speak of rule, what rule are we talking about? Is it
a rule of aggregation and this, I was simply saying, if you adopt the 26, you will be setting a statutory standard for this, as opposed to what is the same transaction, which would be the legal concept. And that's what I thought 26 was. So now I've confused you because I think, I guess that you would need to either adopt 26 or 27. They are two different rules as I have now looked at them. And I don't know which one is it. I don't know which one to prefer. 27 is probably a good choice.
Well, then we have to do that.
I was just going to say, I like 27 for the reason that I think there is a difference between criminal mischief and theft. The spontaneity on criminal mischief, you know.
Senator DiCiardo moves the B-27 amendment. Objection?
Is that revoked?
Mr. Chairman, I think we would need to return to the sensible amendment that Mr. Sherman discussed just a few moments ago, which is in the original bill. And
what I believe it was Bill Penn and Dave Ingerton said yesterday was to clarify which sections constitute an affirmative defense in both Section 3 and Section 4. And I believe that the affirmative defense that the committee would want to look at would be on page 3, line 26.
That's fine.
I think Section B through H constitute an affirmative defense in our case.
This is
on the original bill, and this deals with the affirmative defense issue that we worked on yesterday. And conceptually, we Mr. Ingray and Finn had a good idea, and so now we're going to try and remember what that was and adopt it.
But the original bill is being gross.
Mr. Chairman, the reason that I think that B in Section 3 should probably be included is because it would be a little bit difficult for the prosecution to prove that the defendant was not summoned by an officer beyond a reasonable doubt. Certainly that could be an affirmative defense.
Okay.
Along the same lines, Section 4 could be an affirmative defense, but A would be something that could be brought up in the case in chief.
An outright.
Correct. The way that we read page 3, line 26.
The exception listed in subsection 1, B through H. So the conceptual amendment would be
the 1H to add B dash. And then on line 25 of the same page,
after the number 2, to add sub B through sub F.
Right.
So that took care of the question.
Wait a minute, Jerry says the B, you mean D.
D.
I believe B.
No, not B. B. D, Mr. Chair, I thought.
I thought the affirmative defense would apply to D through F, wouldn't it?
The committee could certainly do that. I think what was discussed yesterday, Mr. Chairman, was C through F, and the question what should the prosecution have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and what should be an affirmative defense? And Senator Tarnow, as I recall your concern, it would be inappropriate to,
as a chief officer, should have to prove that as an affirmative defense.
But I remember on the military armed service, Mr. Ansberry mentioned that unless that was an affirmative defense, they'll just claim they were
right
in the armed service, and then you'd have to disprove it. So we do need to include C.
Okay.
I'm just going to suggest, and maybe the sheriff can answer this, but a person summoned by a police officer to assist in making an arrest, but who are those people?
Well, it could be just any person on the street. They don't have to be armed or anything else. They can just be anyone.
But in this case, to come under this law, they have to be armed.
Right.
And it could be a reserve who has a firearm on him or somebody else.
It seems to me with someone like that, it would be more appropriate to put them under the affirmative defense, because it's like the military, they could say, well, I was summoned.
And you can see that Sheriff Carnell's concern we've answered in Section 3, because if you are retired or authorized, you're covered under that section.
Mm-hmm.
So the sheriff's suggestion would be that we would include B, C, D, E, and F under Section 4 in that conceptual amendment.
So we're going to have to confirm it up here.
This is good.
Yes.
I know something else here in Section 3. I just noticed. And Section D, you make reference to members of the Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Marine, or of the National Guard when on duty. Well, you saw them there. You mentioned the National Guard, which is a reserve kind of force, but you also have the Army Reserve, Navy Reserve, and so forth. And so that,
are they included with the same regard?
No.
They're not?
They're not.
Oh, that's right. You're a colonel.
Right, in the reserve. And so what should, really, I'm just thinking, if you were to say, if you were to start D, if you would say active or reserve members of the Army, Navy, then you would cover it.
That's a good point.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because you've got the National Guard.
Right.
Not the Army Navy Reserve or the Marine Reserve or anybody.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
So basically, what we're doing here, we're making B through H an affirmative defense, and then how is A treated? The current sheriff, you know, active or honorably retired, that is someone who is outright exempted.
Permitted.
Outright permitted.
Yes. Sure.
Senator Burdick, and I should probably make some legislative history on that. The way that would have to be handled is because it's not an affirmative defense. In a case where this charge was prosecuted, the prosecutor would need to establish, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the offender was not a sheriff, constable, marshal, police officer, whether active or honorably retired, parole or probation officer, or other duly appointed police officer. The way to do that would be to simply ask the arresting officer, to the best of your knowledge, was this person a sheriff, constable, etc. Certainly, the defendant could then get on the stand in the defendant's case in chief and try to prove that they were, but it is something that the prosecution would have to establish, and I need to say this for legislative history, as long as State v. Bruff is still good law.
And Mr. Chairman, I wonder if there's any problem on this with parole and probation officers, whether somebody could claim that, whether that would be an undue burden. In other words, we've got active law enforcement in the same category as parole and probation officers. And I'm not even sure what a constable is, but in other words, do they belong in the same category?
Mr. Dan, would you think they would?
Mr. Chair, I'm Senator Burdick at Dale 10, Marion County District Attorney. The question was, do parole and probation officers belong in the same category as police officers and deputy sheriffs? That's the question. I would say yes. And in many counties, you have sheriff's departments, like for instance in Marion County, parole and probation officers are deputy sheriffs. And there has been this cross designation. So I think that's appropriate.
Shouldn't it be covered under the sheriff section of this?
Well, in some counties, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, in some counties there isn't that joinder, but they are armed in their course of duties. And I think that's the concept. Are they armed in the course of their duties? I would simply say that we don't have a problem with leaving those exemptions there. It, in practical terms, this does not come up. This is just designed to make clear that officers in the course of duty who are armed are not subject to this crime. The way this comes up, though, is where we have someone who's going to say, yeah, I have a license, find out where it's from. And then we've got to prove, well, under Brush, we have to prove it anyway, that they don't have a license. And the practical problem. So that's the reason for the amendment. We have no problem keeping those first two exemptions that you identified in your conceptual amendment.
Other questions before we try to restate this conceptual amendment? Senator Duncan.
Oh, I was just going to actually restate those.
All right. Why don't we carefully do probably our most complicated conceptual amendment discussion. The chair would move the following conceptual amendment to House Bill 3374, and we'll begin with Mr. or Senator Duncan, if you could state your addition on line
3, line 8. I would start up by saying active or reserve members.
Thank you.
Okay. And on line 37, I would start by saying and active or reserve member of the budget question. So I agree that we're active or reserve.
Thank you. Then, Mr. Horton, why don't you state the remainder of the conceptual amendments to section 3 and 4?
Mr. Chairman, on page 3, line 26, parentheses 1 and parentheses insert a parentheses B and parentheses dash. And that would be before the H. And on line 45 of the same page, after subsection 2, insert paragraph B on paragraph dash, paragraph F on paragraph.
Questions on the conceptual amendments? Objection? The chair then would move HB3374 as amended many times to the fourth to pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Sorry. I think this would be a simple bill. You shouldn't have controversy in passing, but if someone asked about the amendments, what we did, it gets fairly complicated. I don't care yet.
You went up to Dennis 27, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you did. Okay.
Senator Birdie.
All right. Senator
Young. All right.
Probably, this would be a great one for a rookie to carry. When they first bill on the Senate floor, you could wrap
it up a little further. I know. You look better.
This will be our last bill this morning. House Bill 3395. And we had a conceptual or amendments passed that yesterday. I don't have mine.
I'm sorry. Do we have the U3 3395?
So open the work session on House Bill 3395.
The chairman of the amendments are being brought to committee. The committee has requested that
part of the new provisions in the bill be removed, a provision which establishes that
prior consistent testimony is substantive evidence rather than what is simply is now not substantive, simply there's a version of confusion. That provision would be removed, leaving the remainder of the bill as it is.
Thank you. So, this is a compromise with the chair. We'll allow a expanded use of excited utterances in domestic relations situations. That's basically what would happen. The exception would be when you use a prior statement for purposes of impeachment, that doesn't become substantive evidence by the law. That's the part that's being deleted. So there'd still be an obligation to find some collaborative evidence there. The chair then would move the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 3395. Discussion? Objection? The chair then would move 3395 to the fourth, and it'd be passed. Objection?
This is an expansion of the excited utterance.
Right. The idea is to help on convictions where the domestic couple gets back together again, and usually it's the female partner tries to not be cooperative with. And so this would still allow the district attorney to proceed in those cases.
And Mr. Chairman, your amendment, Jan, limited that?
When it dealt with the issue of impeachment, when you introduce a prior inconsistent statement, you can introduce that statement for purposes of impeachment. But generally, the rules of evidence, it can't be used as substantive evidence. So the jury hears the evidence. You know, hears the what was said. Mm-hmm. That's different now from what the complaining witness is saying. But that's not considered substantive evidence. It's just the purpose of the
hearsay.
It's hearsay.
Exceptions are just a rule.
It is, yes. And you can use it for impeachment. It just doesn't come in as substantive evidence. Objection? So ordered. So I think Senator Graham wanted to carry this out.
I have a cash you with me.
So we will do that. Yeah.
Here's where we are in the rest of the agenda. We're almost through. On 2585, if you recall, this was a bill that failed by a vote on the floor, and there was a question about an amendment to it. Senator Courtney carried it. He had family matter this morning, so he'll be here this afternoon, and I wasn't there to hear the debate, so I don't remember what the issue was. But that's the only thing left on page one. On page two, 3489, we won't do today. That will be tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And by the way, we'll have a very short hearing tomorrow at 1 o'clock. On, then the rest of that page is basically done for the day. And then on
page two, the rest is done
for today. The two we haven't dealt with are page 2352 and 2353, both deal with the ballot title for HJR 87 and 94. On the voter's pamphlet, we're not going to hear that one again. That's dead. On the ballot titles, that depends on how the negotiations go with the Attorney General's office, the proponents, and the governor's office. So we'll only have that if we reach agreement. And then on the third page, 3361, we have a choice there of what amendments to adopt, the page sixes or sevens, and then they're drafting a small amendment dealing with bail when it's not forfeited going to child support. So if those are ready this afternoon, we'll deal with that. And then 2307, we heard a conceptual amendment yesterday, but the language was really difficult to understand. We'll take a look at that this afternoon. That was Ingrid and Dale agreed on the language, but none of us understood it. So we hope to improve upon it. And that's it. So we are just about to
leave another short meeting.
A short meeting this afternoon and a short meeting on Friday. And we've done a lot of work this week. I know that I get tired at night, but we've been going 4 or 5 hours, and we've done some very challenging and difficult things. So I'm proud of the staff and the members of the committee, because I think we did some good stuff. Two questions. We're adjourned. We'll probably have about four, or excuse me, Friday we'll have about four at 1 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll open a work session on HB 3361. Yesterday we have the dash A6A7 in front of us, and we talked about doing something with bail on the A6s, but the wording on the proposal doesn't work for the department, so unless we can figure out a quick way to fix it, we won't encumber the bill. Mr. Taylor.
We may be able to do that. I suggest that Gene will give you up to him. Probably Brad.
Gene and
Scranton. The concerns are that, for example, when you look at the A8 amendments on line 7 and 8, it says, check the state. Yes. The district attorney and so they mentioned to me that under their accounting system, even in the district attorney control, the money goes through their accounting system, and they would add another step. And then number two is going down to page lines 14 and 15 and later 16 and 17, there's language in there that would require that the person who gave the security deposit be notified, and that's contrary to case law. I think we'd be best if they both address the issue.
Okay, so with the deletions that Mr. Taylor just mentioned, Gene, would you have any problems with the bill, with those dash 8 amendments?
No, Chipper, that would work for us. Conceptually, we're fine with this. It was just a couple of technical problems.
Right, Chair Bryant. For the one on the first line, taking out the district attorney, I don't have any problem with. I put in on the amendment giving the person who deposited the money notice because currently it's not statutorily required. This is sort of expanding the statute. It's sort of a political issue about whether or not you want that person to receive notice. Even if they received notice and had a chance to respond, the court could still take the money. This is just a question if you have an in-law, a mother, a brother-in-law, a friend or somebody who posted money, if you're going to use it for child support, whether or not they get notice and an opportunity to respond before you take the money. It's a political question. I don't think it's required practically or legally, and I just put it in so it would be something for you to think about. We are not bound to it one way or the other.
Is currently, when you seize bail, which you do in some areas, now I understand, do you give notice to anyone?
We give notice to the defendant.
All right. And then it's up to the defendant to notify whoever
right.
he got the money from.
And to be fair, the defendant may not have their mother-in-law's interest at heart. After all, this would be credited against their child support arrearages. We do know those people do come to court and are heard because they have several appellate cases on the issue. The security deposit receipt that they sign when they do post the money gives them the warning that the money could be ordered by the court to be used and not be returned to them, even if the person returns to the court appearance. So we're simply concerned. I understand Mr. Swank's perspective is on this, but it sure would be a workload issue for us to have to track down that person and serve them, and I think we're going to have more hearings.
Right now, if let's say the mother-in-law and grandma puts up the money and she says it's my money and I would like it back, she can petition the court to have it,
right. And
it's up to the court to give it back to her now.
Correct.
Does the court have the authority to award the money and give it back to the grandmother if she wants to?
Sure, right, yeah. The court has that discretion. In fact, there is a couple of cases that have gone up to the Court of Appeals on that issue. And, of course, you know, go either way on it, depending on the particular facts of the case. But I do think that it's clear to the person who posts the money that there's a risk involved in posting the money.
Do you need the AAs to go after the bail money? Does this help you in any way?
Sure, Brian, it would clarify the court's authority. Right now, in Multnomah County in particular, there's a local rule that tells the court that they can apply the money posted for any court-ordered obligation. The statute in 135.265 just tells the court that you're going to return 85% of the money posted unless the court orders otherwise. And in other counties, we've gone in and told and argued to the court that they have the discretion to apply that money to this other court-ordered debt. But this would clarify the court's authority to do that.
Okay.
Right now, it seems just very...
It's county by county, then, depending on what the writing judge wants.
That's right. But what's clear in the statute now is that he can apply, the judge can apply money that have accrued under that particular criminal matter, restitution, court costs, attorney's fees. What this does is that it also allows them clearly to apply those funds to other court order obligations.
All right. Yeah, agree.
So what this means is it's not just the defendant, the person who owes the child support, it's not just their money, it's whoever happens to post bail for them. But there, and you said that the notice for when someone posts bail, the notice says that it can be used for other purposes?
Senator Burgess and Chair Bryant, I don't have a copy of what that notice says, and Mr. Speckney, do you know whether it bears
Chair
the county to county?
Senator Burdick, we do advise the courts, we recommend that the courts advise people who are posting bail that can be used for other things because it can be when security release is not forfeited and would be given back to the person if there are outstanding debts
And you said they can petition to get the money back, so it doesn't go to the defendant, right? They can come and petition the court to get the mother-in-law and petition to have the money returned to her. If this went into effect, could the mother-in-law, or maybe let's use a different example, could a friend who had no connection to the family come in and say, these aren't my kids, this isn't my obligation, I want my money back, I don't want this money, this person's child support. Is that allowed under the current system, and would it be allowed here?
Senator Burdick, you're right. I believe they could. The language that we're having a discussion about in the A8 would just expand the requirements of the state to give notice to that person and find them. Right now, the burden's really on them to come forward and make their argument to the court. And the what I guess on the fairness end of this, they're given notice up front that there's a risk involved by posting that money, and this is one of the risks.
And most people who put up the bail money watch their money closely. I mean, they do not forget that. Oh yes, last year I posted $2,000 of bail money for Ronnie, and I wonder where that money is now.
And as I say, Chair Brown, we are not married to that concept. I just thought it was something that should be raised so you could discuss it. If something is reasonably easily removed.
All right, thank you. The chair then would make the following conceptual amendments to the -A8 amendment to House Bill 3361, and Mr. Taylor, you can help me here. On line 7 and 8, deleting the comma and the district attorney. And then going down to line 13.
Line 14.
14.
After defendant deletes and the person comma, if not the defendant comma, who made the security deposit. Delete that.
All right.
And then going down to line 16, after defendant and the person, if not the defendant, who made the security deposit.
Say that again on line 16?
Line 16, and then going on to 17, and the person after defendant, delete the rest of the line, and then delete the first part of line 17 up and through the puzzle. So it reads the defendant
has
an opportunity to respond.
I think I'm slow. The defendant and the person, if not the defendant, has an opportunity to respond.
General, Mr. Committee, in 16, I think we talked about it would say the defendant has an opportunity to respond and request a hearing.
Okay. All right.
Any objection to the conceptual amendments to the -A? Hearing in order, the chair then would move the -A8 amendment to House Bill 3361. Objection to the committee. Our last piece, I believe, Mr. Taylor, on this are whether or not to adopt the -A6 or A7.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Duffy.
I'm sorry, let you stall for a minute. I think Representative Wolf is en route, and I have a question I need to ask him. But
okay.
Mr. Chairman, while that's happening, could we have the... I made a decision between the A6s and the A7s yesterday, and I can't remember what it is. So could we...
Mr. Chairman, would you explain the difference between the A6 and A7 for us?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, can we bring up our national question?
We certainly could.
Basically, what it is, it's what the changing circumstances are going to come back to the court. And it gets into an issue of one being broader than the other, one allowing you to go back beyond that still. But I guess you can do that yourself.
Chair Brandt, Senator Burdick, Mr. Taylor is correct. And to simplify the true difference between 6 and 7, as I understand it, is in the A7s, the language that we're using would allow those parties, obligors or obligees, who have applied for some type of disability, but because of the process through Social Security Administration and then making a determination of your amount of disability, cannot come forward and ask us for a modification. They can, but they don't have a dollar figure for us to use yet, so we cannot grant relief. 6 months, 9 months later, when they do know the dollar amount, and in fact that child receives a lump sum to make up those 6 months that were missed, we would have a calculation, a rule, to allow a credit against past support for that scenario. It's fairly limited. It's for those situations where, through no fault of the party, there was a delay in the Social Security.
And that's the A7.
That's the A7.
More narrow.
Correct. A6
does not speak to just the retroactive judgment, but in fact says, should this become law, at any point someone could come in and request a credit against past support for the fact that their child was receiving Social Security benefits and could ask for that credit back to March 1st, which happens to be the date that we had a standardized formula to calculate Social Security benefits. So in future years, people could continue to come forward and ask for a credit. The concern that we raised about that one is it does not continue to encourage people to ask for modification actions in a timely manner, which is what we always want people to do. If your order is not compliant, please come forward and tell us.
Mr. Chairman, when you talk about adjusting, you're talking about someone having to pay less, right? But you're also talking about someone receiving less. Am I correct?
Chair Bryant and Mr. Taylor, that is correct. What we were talking about in this rule is someone had a child support obligation, say, for $200 a month, and they're asking for a credit against those missed payments of $200 a month. So instead of collecting $200 a month for the custodial parent, yes, we would possibly be collecting something less.
And they'd be receiving, the custodial parent would be receiving less.
Chair Bryant, Mr. Taylor, ultimately the child would receive, yes, that is correct.
And in that scenario, if there was a payment and then the obligor got credit for it, and it turned out then when you apply that credit, there was actually an overpayment. If there was a continuing obligation, then that would be a credit against that overpayment, or that overpayment would be a credit against your continuing obligation.
Sure, Brent, that is one of the possible scenarios and often comes up in our partnering states where they do a dollar-for-dollar credit. That is why we have asked for rulemaking authority. We would attempt to draft a rule with the help of all of our partners to avoid an overpayment situation so that the custodial family was not put in harm. If that should occur, there would be options there, such as a credit against future support.
And your concern would be if there was no future support owed, and suddenly there could be $1,000 that would be a credit that the custodial parent might suddenly owe.
Sure, Grant, that is correct. It is likely that the state would be in a position of refunding that money, but ultimately we would then have a collection action against that custodial parent.
Right. And both of these amendments would allow you to have that rulemaking authority to address that, correct?
That is correct.
Representative Witt, thank you for coming down. Senator Duncan had a question for you.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I guess my concern was I knew that Representative Witt, I believe, had some reference on them, -7 and -6 amendments, and I kind of I thought I remembered, but I needed to hear from him again.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, at this point, I don't even have copies of the -6 and -7. They appeared after I gave testimony yesterday. And Mr. Hoyman reviewed them, and frankly, I have not discussed them with Mr. Hoyman, so I can't with absolute certainty recall. Thank you.
And they're not easy to understand when you read them. At least we've had to have them explained to us two or three times. I believe the -A6 would be more to your liking because it gives broader authority and allows a person to go back in a broader time frame to request credit for the payment of Social Security or Veterans Benefits.
It seems to me like that significant set, right? Hoyman?
Hoyman, yes.
Hoyman was referring, not that we're just doing something just for him, I mean, I guess this is where it got started, was seven, I think it was that capital, and that's where I got confused, and that's why I wanted to
Senator, that was my recollection, too, but I can't say with certainty, and I have not gone through these carefully enough and inserted them into the bill to get a clear understanding of them. Of course, what I was offering was the -2 amendments, which provided the dollar-for-dollar offset, which my information shows 39 of the 50 states in the United States do. I'm concerned about giving the department rulemaking authority on these issues. because I don't think they're getting to the base cause of the problem with a number of people that's exemplified in Mr. Hoyman's case.
The committee, I do not believe that we'll adopt the dash twos because of the difference we have in the way we calculate our child support obligations than from other states. And I'm convinced in my experience when I did domestic relations work and from the testimony that unless dollar for dollar might work for the state of Washington based on the way they determine their child support obligation, but with the formula that's used here, it's a consideration because it reduces the amount of child support, but it's not dollar for dollar. And if we went dollar for dollar, we'd have to readjust the whole formula on the child support. And I'm unwilling to do that portion. I'm telling you that so that I think we've improved the bill with what we've offered here from the way it came over that house, especially since we've included veterans benefits that weren't, and allow for a retroactivity to go back and make application for this and not be prejudiced by the fact that you hadn't filed a motion, but I do not believe we'll go to the dash twos.
Mr. Chairman, I will, if you're not going to adopt the dash twos, I'll trust your judgment in terms of how you want to move this forward. I do want to say that Mr. Hoyman, first of all, is not my constituent. He came to a hearing in Judiciary Committee in the House when this bill was initially heard. Came to me and talked about his situation. I am convinced he has not been treated fairly by the state of Oregon. And I think there's other people that are in the same situation. And this is a man who's a disabled veteran who was serving our country. And frankly, I think he has been treated abusively by the state of Oregon. And I think some of the folks in the department have played games with him and have not dealt straight with him. And because of that, this man lives in Marion County. He's a long way from my district. Because of that, I've tried to represent his cause here. If Mr. Chairman, if you do not want to drop the dash twos, I'll trust you to do what you believe is the best thing at this thing and move this bill forward.
Thank you. And what we are going to adopt will help you.
I appreciate that.
I think from his standpoint, I think the seven is the better one.
Well, I'll tell you what. Since we don't have a quorum, Senator Sarno, well, now why don't we ask you, which of the two amendments, the dash A6s or the dash A7s, would be most beneficial to Mr. Hoyman?
Chair Bryant, if I understand Mr. Hoyman's case correctly, I think both versions will allow him another opportunity to seek a modification request. But with regard to the issue of past support, I believe that the A6s would offer him the possibility of some relief back to the date of March 1st, but not clear back to the date his children originally were receiving. The A7s, I do not believe would. I don't think his children received the retroactive lump sum judgment. I think this has been an ongoing issue for Mr. Hoyman.
So the dash sixes would offer him a little more relief.
This is terrible. A man sits in my house and tells me something, and then the next day I can't remember. Really?
Chair Bryant and Senator Duncan, my notes do reflect that yesterday Mr. Hoyman spoke to the dash sevens, but I do not believe he had a lot of time to look at them.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, what I might be able to do is try to get a hold of Mr. Hoyman on the phone.
And we'll wait till tomorrow, Bill, so that we meet again tomorrow at 1. And
this is that Boy Scout.
I think I might have a phone number for him. Okay.
And so why don't we do that? I believe the dash A6s would offer him a better opportunity than the A7.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that because I should have remembered that I didn't write it down, and I thought that's something I won't forget.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be tomorrow morning.
1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay, I appreciate that, and I'll be back at that time.
And you can either let Senator Duncan or myself know it's not necessary that you come.
And I'll write it down when you tell me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The final bill is we're closing in the work session on 3361. Our final one is 2307, and I don't have a quorum right now, as you can see. So our
Are both of you going to be here tomorrow? If you trust the three of us, you want to come forward and make your case now, and you can have your Friday afternoon off. So why don't you try to do that? Well, this goes back on 2307, and we're down now to just looking at the C11. And the first two lines they've agreed to delete. So the issue is what classification of felony this should be. And we've heard their statements once, and I thought it'd be confusing to hear the statements one more time before we make a decision. So, Mr. Penn, why don't you go first and explain why you want the increase in penalty to the Class A and Class B, and then allow Ingrid to respond. And I'm going to take notes.
Mr. Chair, Dale Penn, Marin County District Attorney, appreciate the opportunity. The reason for the bill is that presently these cases are primarily prosecuted as C felonies, either a criminal mistreatment situation, which can take a misdemeanor assault in a custodial situation where it's a parent, a babysitter, that type of thing, and it becomes a Class C felony. Remember, our problem is that based upon a Court of Appeals decision, if we had serious physical injury before for shaking a baby, that type of thing, we would have in the past filed it as a ballot measure 11 assault. But it would be a knowing act. And we are unable to prove knowing given a redefinition of the term knowing. And so these cases must be charged then and proved as reckless assaults. So that was the reason for the bills. We are willing to go with the Dash 10 amendments, which narrow the number of these assaults that will be prosecuted at a higher degree. And these are the ones where there's physical injury, right? And so we've agreed to narrowing those. The Dash 11 amendments, though, wish to reduce the penalty for the highest level of assault that we want for infants, and this is the assault that has serious physical injury. And that is the case where you have life-threatening injury, serious permanent injury. So we talk about the brain damage situations, the permanent scarring. These are life-threatening types of injury of a child under three, infants. And we strongly believe that those kinds of cases where the child has that kind of lifetime injury should be at this elevated A felony sentencing. Now, we have not put it in ballot measure 11. This would be a sentencing guidelines sentence. It would qualify for good time, regular type of sentencing, but it is at a higher level. So we see right now these are C felonies, as I've described. We're trying to move them up to take the physical injury ones to B felony, and we've limited them with the Dash 10 amendments, and we'd like to have the permanent serious physical injuries go up to the A felony situation. That's where we're at. And because of that, I would be opposed to the Dash 11 amendments.
And for a felony, what would a judge consider when they look at the sentencing chart? What would be the general time frame?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's going to... It would establish the presumptive sentence of 70 months. And that could be departed up or departed down based upon prior record. But the presumptive sentence would be 70 months. Again, good time is available, and the judge has discretion to go down or go up.
And the max would be 20 years?
Yes.
Thank you. Senator Berger.
if someone were walking down the street and attacked somebody with a hammer or with a whatever, even shot him in the head and caused permanent brain damage, perhaps making him a vegetable and making him disabled for the rest of your life, what level of crime is that?
Ms. Chairman, Senator Burdick, let me take the hammer one. And you have a weapon. Okay, so that's always going to aggravate that into the felony assault, and it's probably going to aggravate it into a ballot measure 11 offense. Typically, those described circumstances would be either assault 2 or assault 1, ballot measure 11 crimes.
And would that be a B felony, an A felony?
An A or B felony, but they would have the ballot measure 11 mandatory minimums with no good time, no capability for the judge to come down, which we have all those mitigators in this. Now, if a weapon was involved against a small infant, we would probably be filing it as a ballot measure 11 type crime. These types of assaults are again trying to get at the baby shaking situation and the injuries, broken arms, broken legs, even fractured skulls in small infants that they heal very well and they don't have permanent disability from.
So I think we established earlier that with someone that small, their hands really are a weapon, that in a way that they would not be for adults.
Ms. Chair and Senator Burdick, in practical terms, that's our motivation for this bill. In legal terms, we cannot charge hands as weapons, but with these small infants, we believe that's a very aggravated case, and it should have higher sentences.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Ingrid Thompson, Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. On the other hand, if a person were to commit this offense that's described in the Class A level felony against an adult, not a child, with the elements that are set forth there, we're talking about an A misdemeanor or possibly a C felony if there were extreme indifference to the value of human life. But if you just took reckless conduct, which resulted in serious physical injury, that's a misdemeanor if you're talking about an adult. So we're talking about a difference between a Class A misdemeanor for injuring an adult, say a child of 4 or a child of 5, but a Class A felony for identical conduct with respect to a child. Proportionality is something that is a difficult concept to maintain in the criminal law, but the assault statutes on the whole have maintained that fairly well by aggravating the offense for adding an element. So the weapon, for example, is an element that aggravates it to either a B or C felony, or the nature of the injury. And the other variable has been the state of mind. So we punish people who do things intentionally, like with the hammer, much more seriously than people who do things recklessly. And as Mr. Penn said, he has been unable to establish to a jury satisfaction in a lot of these cases that the defendant knew that this was going to be the result. And so all he can show is a reckless state of mind, which says, you know, I disregarded a substantial and known risk. That's what the defendant did, but did not intend to harm that child. So what I suggested as a compromise position in these amendments, and certainly not something we feel is necessary, but as a compromise to elevate it, to make a statement about children, if you add an element, which is that the child is under 3, and you aggravate what would otherwise be criminal mistreatment of Class C or assault 4, a Class A misdemeanor, aggravate it to a Class B felony, you have made a very strong statement because, again, all you have is reckless conduct, not intentional. You have no weapon, but you do have serious physical injury. That isn't always life-threatening. It means permanent, basically, loss of function of some bodily organ. So that can be an internal organ, it can be a limb, it can be permanent scarring of some kind. There are other things than life-threatening injuries that are serious physical injuries. And if you were to allow the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to set the sentence range here, very likely they would look at assault in the second degree that has been removed from ballot measure 11 and categorized as 9 on the guidelines grid. That would mean the range of sentencing would run from 34 months at the bottom if you had no criminal record of any significance to, I'm sorry, I think it's up to about 70 months on the top end if you had a significant criminal record. So it would be a strong response to those kinds of cases. We recognize the independent significance of the age of the child by making it an element. It would make it a very serious felony. Thank you so much. And let's see, it would be the top range is 72 months for category 9. So the sentence would range from 34, these are presumptive sentences, 34 months to 72. The court could aggravate or mitigate that sentence under guidelines, but that's the range that we'd be talking about.
If we didn't adopt Section 4, which sets the presumptive term and just allowed the Criminal Justice Commission to go through their regular process to determine the presumptive sentence, and left it at an A and a B, not measure 11, what would category would it be then?
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Finn would have a better idea. I think they would struggle with what that would look like, because obviously the legislature would have designated it a fairly serious felony, but they would also probably look at the elements and say, what's the closest thing to these elements that's already on the grid?
And they have to take in consideration proportionality when that happens. And aren't you the chair of that commission?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The commission would look at the other crimes that are and try to find a similar sentence that is comparable in the statutes. But they would look at this and say the legislature is giving a method to aggravate sentencing, and then it would come down to a vote. And then the commission's determination would come back to you as the legislature to ratify.
But in the interim, the judges would use what the commission comes up with.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I would simply note one other thing, and that is this bill does need to go to Ways and Means, and so it has difficulties given this time of the session. But
we now have a quorum, and the chair's purpose would be to move it to them. I think it does address an important issue, and our motion will be to send what we decide to do down to Ways and Means, and the sooner we get it there, the better as far as its opportunity to be heard and decided. And the reason it hasn't decided earlier is this came over very late. But that's a lot of criminal matters came over really late.
Well, that's because we've made so many concessions on this bill already, Mr. Chair.
On the House side. Well, thank you. Other questions? What I'd like to do then is, Mr. Taylor, were you here yesterday when we adopted? No, we didn't adopt.
Chairman, John Horton, Superintendent of the School, we've been laying down. I think he's up.
On your compromise language, do you remember if we adopted that conceptual language?
You're talking about A-10?
Right.
So they had that reasonable people and so forth.
Do you have that language available?
By legislative counsel,
may have gone
to Mr. Horton rather than.
If you call him, see Mr. Horton,
too. Who do you want?
We're on 2307.
I can tell you what it says.
Tell me what it says.
It says.
Yeah, well, you write this down.
This is in line 13 of the Hayden Gross Bill.
Line 13.
After age, insert, under circumstances that a reasonable person would perceive as creating more than a remote risk of serious physical injury.
Creating more than a remote risk
of serious physical injury.
Risk
chairman of the committee has requested the bill.
More than a remote risk of serious physical injury.
And then you complete the sentence who is under 3 years of age.
Oh, excuse me, it was after age.
After age. Okay. I understand. Chair would move that as a conceptual amendment then to be added to House Bill 2307.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
For Section 2, one read under circumstances manifesting extreme, would that be part of the language on, or that hasn't changed, or we talked about that yesterday, I believe.
No, that would remain the same, wouldn't it? That's right. We'll come, and that will be the, we'll come to that in just one moment. Any other discussion on the conceptual amendment? And this is the language that was submitted yesterday. If not, that language is adopted. And they tell me that there is clear legal understanding for those terms. Now, we will go to the dash 11, and they've agreed to delete 1 and 2. So the issue, lines 1 and 2, so the issue before us is whether or not to go to the Class A and the Class B. Here's my thinking on it. Since it's not Measure 11, and we're going to be dealing with presumptive sentences, and the fact that we are talking about children under the age of 3, I'm inclined to go with the Class A felony on line 9 and the Class B on line 14.
As it is.
I would delete Section 4 because I think this is part of a position that this is what the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission is to determine what the presumptive sentence would be. And they might very well come up with what's proposed here, but they should, I think, go through their exercise. And so what does my quorum think of that? Okay. All right. Then the chair would move that we delete Section 4 of the bill, which is lines 19 through 24. Objection? Bring them through. Yeah. Chair then would move House Bill 2307 as amended before due pass.
If I could add one thing, Mr. Horton just informed me the language we talked about earlier.
In concept of the A-12.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Okay, those were the conceptual A and A-12. Coming a little bit late, I guess I should inquire for my own purposes. Do the conceptual amendments do the identical thing to the A-12? Ingrid?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen any A-12.
I don't think we've seen them yet. What we'll do is if there's a problem, alert me and we can bring the bill back. So the motion then would be to send the HB 2307 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with the favorable recommendation. Discussion, objection, forward. Thank you once again, committee. 1 o'clock, and I hope to be out by 2 tomorrow. We have probably about 4 or 5 bills, and most of pretty.
If you get a good senior from Portland to cooperate, it would be all right.
Yeah, she's very much. Is there going to be some report tomorrow on 2353? Are we making progress, or should I not waste my time and put it up again?
Okay.